Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on June 14, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Sattusasana Sutta. The Sattusasana Sutta is a concise sutta presented to a monk well-versed in the Buddha's teachings. He has developed understanding of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. In this sutta, the Buddha is refining his mindfulness and teaching him what is most important to hold in mind. There were also a few newcomers at tonight's class, and so I gave a brief talk on the as an introduction to the Buddha's teachings, and that's included in the talk. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. How was that, Lorraine?
Okay, my legs were falling asleep.
That's okay. You were able to...
I had to stretch out a little.
The instructions, the guidance was helpful. You were able to,
yeah.
And it really comes down to just being mindful that you're caught up in your thoughts and come back to your breath. And every time we do that, we're deepening our concentration. So it's not even a, it's the goal isn't even to simply be mindful of your breath. That's impossible. It's just to use the breath to deepen concentration. And so every time that we find that we're caught up in our thoughts and come back to our breath, we're deepening our concentration. And that avoids frustration that you just can't do it for 20 minutes or whatever you think. How was that for you, Paul?
It's good.
Yeah, and you were able to maintain the method?
I just constantly brought myself back because my mind would wander.
Yeah.
And I focus on my belly again, and then my mind would wander and so on.
That's it. That's meditation.
Okay. Yeah, I know.
And the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path are supportive of deepening your meditation practice. And as your meditation practice deepens and you develop more concentration, you're able to integrate more of the Eightfold Path. So it's not a linear path. It's a very symbiotic path. We develop it basically all at the same time, but different aspects of the path have more meaning to you. So let me just give a brief introduction to all of this. I'll preface by saying on the website there's a page for new visitors. That gets you going in the right direction. And then in the drop-down menu under Dhamma Articles and Talks, which is on the home page, mm-hmm. there's a page that says Introduction to the Dhamma. And that is a series, it's a video and a couple of talks with a little bit of text that describes, again, what this is all about, why this is such an effective meditation practice, and how mindfulness is applied in this practice. So the Buddha taught a very specific application of mindfulness, and again, it's to be mindful of, to hold in mind the principles of the Eightfold Path. Siddhartha Gautama was born a prince in his father's kingdom in northern India, really, which is southern Nepal at the time, or now, it was still part of India then. And he was given everything that a prince's, a king's son would have. And in fact, his father really went overboard, hoping to satisfy every desire that young Siddhartha might have so that he would stay within the kingdom, because his concern was that his son was so bright and inquisitive about humanity that he would leave the kingdom and go seek answers, which is exactly what happened when he was 29 years old. So 29 years old, he finally left the palace grounds, and for the first time he was walking through the town unescorted. And he, for the first time in his life, he saw sickness. He saw a man that was obviously ill. He saw a body on the side of the road, and he asked his handler, his name was Chandi, he says, why is this man sleeping on the side of the road? And he says, he's not sleeping, he's dead. And since young Siddhartha had never come across anything like that, he was shielded from anything that might be construed as suffering or even disappointment, that he was so shocked that we live this life and all of us are going to end up like that man on the side of the road. And that got him, his thinking, going in a direction towards solving the riddle of suffering. And so he began wandering around northern India, and for the next 6 years he did so, hoping to find an answer, if there was one, to the nature of suffering, and is there a way that individuals could bring an end to their own suffering and their own confusion, their own deluded thinking. Along the way, he noticed the competitiveness and the aggressiveness of people. He noticed the violence that he never saw before. The world at the time of the Buddha, this is 2,600 years ago, is very, very similar. You could say it's almost exactly the same issues were around then as there are now. of course, things are much more immediate, and we're much more globally aware of what's occurring. But there was just the same competitiveness, aggressiveness, violence back then as there is now. After wandering around northern India for 6 years, he studied with some of the most advanced so-called spiritual teachers of his time. Two that were prominent were a man named Alara Kalama and another was Udeka Ramaputta. He studied and mastered both of these teachings. And their teachings were rooted in the Vedas and then later the Upanishads, which are the precursor to modern Hinduism. He studied and mastered these techniques. They both had meditation techniques attached to them, and he got immediately. So much so that both of those teachers asked Siddhartha to come and join their Sangha and represent them. And he rejected them both as not leading to his goal of understanding. So he continued to wander around northern India, and he started studying and developing these very severe ascetic practices, which was common at the time too. And it's said that, you know, the Buddha talks about, he was eating a grain of rice or one bean a day, and he got so emaciated that he could touch his spine by touching his belly. He eventually became very ill, and he's walking down the street one day. Let me go back just a little bit. Prior to that, he had left five of his friends that he was wandering around with, all seeking understanding. So he's wandering around, wandering down the road one day, and he passes out from not taking care of himself, and he rolled down a little hill into the edge of a river, and a young girl, 12-year-old girl named Sujata, pulled him out of the river, saved his life, and nursed him back to health with some rice and other common foods at the time. As the Buddha started regaining his strength, he realized that the way he was seeking understanding wasn't working. Now remember, he was brought up as a prince in his father's kingdom. He had everything that he could ever want. He could indulge his senses continually, no matter what he wanted. And then he lived the other extreme of denying himself even the most basic human needs. And he realized that those extremes were not the path. They just, he classified both of them as painful and ignoble. Even having all the luxuries, to him, was painful. When he talked about his life in the world that way, he talked about it as a confining place. Now, most people would take those kind of riches that he had as freedom, but he recognized it even at an early age as confining and frustrating, because he, even at a very young age, he had an unrecognized insight into what's the value in all this stuff. And so he decided, out of this frustration from all the seeking, that he was now going to meditate until he developed the understanding that he was looking for. And he remembered a meditation that he had done when he was 5 years old. And he was equally as frustrated with what was going on around him. And he decided to sit under this tree in his dad's backyard, basically, and to just be mindful of his breath until his mind calmed. And it worked. And so now, 30 years later, he remembered that little meditation method, and he decided to do it again. And so the Buddha sat, or Siddhartha still, sat in meditation. The tales, the legends are, any amount of time from one night to 40 nights, the length really isn't important. What is important is what he developed an understanding of. And what he came to grips with was his own thought constructs that were rooted in ignorance, and I'll tell you what that ignorance is in just a moment, that created misunderstanding and deluded expectations of life. And it is that that led to the suffering, and it is that type of confused and deluded thinking that led to all the confusion and aggressiveness that he saw around him. So through this rather intense meditation, he came to an understanding. And he came to an understanding of something called the three marks of existence. That all things in the world are impermanent, including ourselves and including our thoughts. That because we don't understand something called Four Noble Truths, we create wrong views rooted in ignorance of those Four Noble Truths. And because of those wrong views, we create a misunderstanding of who we are. The word that the old ancient Pali word for that is anatta. It's a misapplied word today, but it simply means that the views we're holding of ourselves do not constitute in reality as self. So the Buddha's teaching is recognize and abandon those views. Because we don't understand the relationship between wrong views and the impermanent world that we live in, we create the third mark of existence, dukkha, or ongoing suffering. And that's a very broad term. It means anything from a mild disappointment, mild unsatisfactory experiences, all the way to extreme emotional and physical suffering. Dukkha occurs. Excuse me. So the Buddha awakened to something called dependent origination, which states that from ignorance of Four Noble Truths through 12 observable causative links, all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering arises. So his very first teaching then was to teach the Four Noble Truths. And he taught it to those five friends that he was wandering around northern India, in India with prior to this. Basically, the Four Noble Truths, and they're presented in slightly different ways depending on the context. But the first noble truth is that dukkha occurs, which, and it sounds like such a simple and almost mundane statement, but what the Buddha is now teaching is that simply as a consequence of having a human life, there is going to be unsatisfactory experiences. We cannot escape it, so we should stop trying to. And he described dukkha as birth is suffering, or painful, or dukkha. Dukkha is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Aging is suffering. Death is suffering. All things that we're aware of, isn't it? But we create strategies because we don't want to face the disappointing and unsatisfactory nature of our life. And that's the beginning of wrong views. He went on to describe dukkha in this way. Not getting what we want is dukkha, is suffering. Getting what we don't want is suffering. And then he would, sometimes there's a little bit longer elaboration on that, but he would always conclude that description of suffering in this way. And he would say, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. And this is where we can you can become a little bit confused because of the terminology. It's enough to know that the five clinging aggregates, which are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness, now this is thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, these are the five clinging aggregates. It simply describes the personal experience of suffering. And so put that aside right now. Don't try to make sense of it because you need a broader context. But one of the ways that I teach, and I learned this from reading how the Buddha teaches, is we say things over and over again, repetitively, but in different contexts. And so eventually you'll gain an understanding of what this terminology means and you'll be able to put it together. But that's also why I wrote those books. So suffering occurs. The second noble truth is that craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. And this is now we're getting to our individual contributions to our suffering and our confusion. Craving for what? Well, craving for things to be different than they are. When we don't get what we want, we crave for it. I only got one piece of chocolate cake. I want three or four. I didn't get the job that I wanted. I got a lesser job. I didn't meet the girl of my dreams. I met someone lesser than that. I didn't get my brand new car. I had to buy a secondhand car. Life is full of disappointments. When we want life to be different than it is, we create further suffering in our lives, don't we? Or we might crave for something to not happen. We start worrying about the future. That's a form of craving. It's also known as aversion. So craving and aversion are the same thing, just different sides of the same coin. Once we decide what we need to be happy and to be safe and secure and what we don't want to have, we start clinging to those ideas. And so we've now created a mindset of how our life must be in order for us to be happy. Except we forget that first mark of existence, impermanence. No matter how much stuff we can gather, it's all impermanent. No matter how many ideas we might become enamored with and hold in our mind, they're impermanent. They come and go. Meditation shows us that. What we eventually gain an understanding of is that since all things are impermanent, to be mindful of what's occurring and to be completely accepting of what's occurring. We learn to the differentiation between acceptance and approval. Why do we accept what's occurring? Because it's what's occurring. It's simply an aspect of wisdom of a fully mature human being. A child gets upset when he can't get any more cookies out of the cookie jar. An adult, someone who has grown past that, knows that one or two cookies is enough and they leave the cookie jar alone. But most of us never gain that type of maturity that we don't keep looking for more cookies. Nothing satisfies a self-referential ego self. And this is something, this is the brilliance of an awakened human being. He recognizes. But he taught how to recognize it in a very simple terms that any human being can develop in this lifetime. Am I giving you too much information?
No.
Okay. It is a lot of information, and I don't expect you to integrate it or even remember it all, but just to lay the foundation for what's to come. The third noble truth, and it's probably the most important one, but they're all important, and it relates to impermanence, is cessation of our own process of creating suffering in our lives is possible. We can do it. And how do we know we can do it? Because a human being did it, and now he's teaching us. Siddhartha did it, he became a Buddha, and he left his teachings called the Dhamma. They're still here today. That's one of the reasons why I said before, the only thing I teach is what can be found in the Sutta Pitakas, because it's the only thing that I know that I can leave my own views out of and teach what an awakened human being did. I wish there was more of that today. The fourth noble truth is that the path leading to the cessation of our own contributions to suffering, the path leading to the cessation of confused and deluded thinking and ongoing unsatisfactory experiences is the Eightfold Path. This is the only path the Buddha ever taught, excuse me. And what's remarkable when you read the suttas and understand the context that I just gave you, the Buddha awakened to dependent origination, he taught the Four Noble Truths, including the Eightfold Path. Everything that he would teach for the next 45 years of his teaching career was taught in the context of those first two understandings. And that's so important, because then you can pick any sutta which might not even mention dependent origination, Four Noble Truths, or Eightfold Path, and you'll know how to apply it. And that's one of the things that we talk about a lot here. So the three marks of existence, again, are all things are impermanent. The views that I'm holding of a self are not based in reality. They're not a self. I need to recognize and let go of those views. And until I do so, life is going to be aspects of suffering in that life. Does that make relative sense to both of you?
Yeah, it does.
Good. It's really not, and I don't mean that you shouldn't, but it's a lot of information all at once. And the difficulty that we all have in developing this is many of these teachings are so contradictory to the way we've conditioned our mind to be. And a conditioned mind is a mind that is conditioned from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And that really is the problem. The Buddha recognized this upon his awakening. And upon his awakening, he sat off and on in meditation for about another 2 weeks, considering, is there a way to teach this that is going to be able to pierce that common veil of ignorance? And if you think about it, a mind that is deluded has no reference point to know it's deluded, does it? The Buddha recognized this in his brilliance, and so he gave us this Eightfold Path so that we could identify, recognize, and abandon all views rooted in ignorance of these Four Noble Truths. That's the entire purpose of the Buddha's teachings. And again, then every sutta he ever gave was situational and related to that. And so this sutta tonight is called the Sattasasana Sutta. And you'll see how it relates to everything that the Buddha, that I just described, the foundations of the Buddha's teachings. And it's given to a senior monk, whose name is Upali, who already has a profound understanding of these things. So the Buddha doesn't go over it again, because he knows that Upali always has already developed this understanding. But it's a really important sutta, and it's really appropriate for newcomers too. So let me read the sutta. I'll just go into the introduction briefly. And please feel free, if there's any questions you have as I'm going through this, just let me know.
Okay.
We're very informal here. The Sattasasana Sutta is a concise, let me just stop there. So I send an email out, newsletter out on Monday and Thursday, and they describe and have a link to whatever sutta I'll be teaching at the Tuesday and Wednesday class, and then the Thursday email describes what will be on the Thursday class and the Saturday class. But I should say that I put the wrong link in for Thursday's class. Did anybody click on that link for last week's? There wasn't a link for the Sattasasana Sutta in today's email.
There were videos. Yeah, there wasn't nothing.
Yeah, that was the introduction to the
yeah.
But I usually, when I'm well concentrated and mindful enough, I put the right links in there. You can sign up for that on the website. The Sattasasana Sutta is a concise sutta presented to a monk well-versed in the Buddha's teachings. He has developed understanding of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. He has integrated the framework of the Eightfold Path, and through Upali's integration of the Eightfold Path, he has developed skillful insight into those three marks of existence. So here the Buddha is teaching Upali refined mindfulness. Mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. So an important aspect of mindfulness is simply to remember that whatever we hold in mind is going to determine our experience in life. And what we associate with is another aspect of mindfulness. What we associate with and who we associate with is going to determine, to a great extent, the experiences of our life. In this case, we find mindfulness then is to hold in mind and integrate the principles of the Eightfold Path as our path to awakening. Makes sense, doesn't it? And that's really the only way that the Buddha taught mindfulness. There's other scenarios that the Buddha goes through, but this is why we develop mindfulness, so that we can hold in mind the principles of the Eightfold Path. A skillful understanding of the Buddha's Dhamma clearly shows that it is as important to understand what to dismiss from mindfulness as it is to what to hold in, to what to hold in mind, meaning the eight factors of the Eightfold Path. So what that last line means is that we, as we start developing concentration and start integrating this framework of the Eightfold Path, we then begin to recognize our own thoughts, words, and ideas that are rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And through that recognition, we can simply let them go and begin to hold in mind the principles of the Eightfold Path. What we're finding out now, but what the Buddha recognized 2,600 years ago, is that we really can hold in mind only one direction for ourselves. And so as we develop the Eightfold Path, we create a situation in our lives that brings awakening to this present moment. In other words, with the right frame of mind, holding in mind the right factors, the Eightfold Path, each moment holds the potential to incline our minds towards awakening and away from ignorance and the resulting suffering from that. And that's what that takes some time to develop, but it doesn't take lifetimes. The Buddha was an awakened human being who taught other human beings how to awaken in this lifetime, meaning gaining full human maturity. So all the legends and stuff about it takes endless eons, please don't read that stuff. But that's often how awakening is presented. It's not something that an awakened human being taught. It's something that was later added on. And really the reason why is that much of what occurs after the Buddha's passing was to create religion out of something that was never meant to be religious. The Buddha never saw himself as savior, and he never taught anything that could be seen as a salvific religion. He taught a practical way of living in reality. So this is the sutta. The Satisasana Sutta. One day, Venerable Upali asked the Buddha, "Please provide a concise teaching on your Dhamma so that I may continue to develop understanding in seclusion, free of distraction, ardent and alert with skillful determination." One aspect of the Eightfold Path, the sixth aspect, is right effort. Let me just say what they are now. The eight factors of the Eightfold Path is right view. And notice how the using the terminology implies that there's such a thing as wrong view. Another word that we could use is skillful or unskillful or appropriate or inappropriate. But right and wrong really gets to the point. So the first factor is right view. It directly addresses that problem of wrong view or views rooted in ignorance of the way things are. The second factor is right intention. And it relates directly to the second noble truth that says craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. So right intention is the intention holding in mind and recognizing and abandoning craving and clinging. The next three factors are called the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path. They're right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Again, the implication is that there's such a thing as wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood. Most people, when they start developing the Dhamma, will be able to utilize the moral and ethical aspects most readily. And most people will see it in right speech and wrong speech. So right speech basically is harmless speech. It's free of gossip. It's free of anything. It's honest speech. It's free of anything that could be seen as creating conflict within ourselves or with others. And most of us, when we start holding in mind, will recognize aspects of wrong speech. And they're not sins. We're not going to be punished for those. But they'll simply create conflict in our own minds. And the more that we can align ourselves with the skillful aspects of right speech, right action, right livelihood, the peaceful will be. It also supports deepening concentration. If we're engaged in a lot of the wrong or unskillful or inappropriate actions in our life, our minds will simply be too disrupted to quiet and calm. The next three factors are right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. So the implication is that there's such a thing as wrong effort. Wrong effort would be try to attach or integrate teachings that the Buddha never taught into his teachings. That's simply indifference to an awakened human being. Right mindfulness implies that there's such a thing as wrong mindfulness, doesn't it? So wrong mindfulness would be holding in factors that continue our own ignorance and create suffering in our lives. And right meditation would be engaging in what the Buddha taught as meditation, what we just did, which is called shamatha vipassana meditation, and avoiding other things that may be more of a distracting aspect and not lead to deepening concentration. So simple breath meditation in the sitting position at a chair is fine, but what I'm saying is not laying down or not using like walking meditation as a substitute. Sitting the body down, quieting the body begins to quiet the mind, and then using the appropriate technique. So that's the Eightfold Path. Sounds like a lot, but it's very easily integrated. So the Buddha responds to Upali. Upali, you know those qualities of mind that do not lead to utter disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, nor to unbinding from self-referential views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Be mindful that these, now again, Upali knows the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. The Buddha is reminding him and refining his mindfulness and putting the focus on this. Be mindful that these qualities are not the Dhamma and they are not the Vinaya. The Vinaya is simply a set of disciplines for monks and nuns to follow. These are not the teacher's instructions. So even then, well, not even then, there was just as much confusion about what a useful path, just to put a loose term on it, a spiritual path was. There were many, just as many different teachers all espousing the same thing. You listen to me, I got the answers. And there was always much confusion. The Buddha's addressing that in Upali's mind, saying you need to let go of all that other stuff and focus on what you know the Dhamma to be. This is the teacher's instructions. Which makes sense. If you're going to follow someone's teachings, you'll actually follow those teachings and not make them something else, which unfortunately is a lot of what has happened. The Buddha continues, the qualities of mind that you know that lead to utter disenchantment, to dispassion, and this is disenchantment with continuing to maintain wrong views, the utter disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding from self-referential views, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Be mindful that these qualities are the Dhamma and they are the Vinaya, the discipline. These are your teacher's instructions. And that's the end of this concise teaching. So the interesting thing about this sutta is the scenario is, this is a senior monk who has developed a lot of the Dhamma, but he still needs to be reminded to keep your focus on the Dhamma and not on other things. And of course, I'm not talking about outside of the Dhamma, meaning, you know, if we, whatever we might want to do, it's okay to do that, but don't look at it as Dhamma practice. A good example might be if we do yoga. Yoga is great for many people, although there's a lot of injuries, but the philosophy is completely different than what the Buddha taught. It doesn't mean that it's wrong or bad or anything, but we can get very confused when we try to integrate one philosophy into another. It's best to keep this as it is, as a simple Eightfold Path that directly delivers what it promises. So that's tonight's talk. Thank you for listening. I'll start with Lorraine. So what we do now is we go around the room. If you have any questions or you want to talk about your Dhamma practice or whatever, you never have to say anything, though. It's okay to pass. But we'll start with you. So I'm so glad you came tonight. So. Paul.
Hi. What you spoke about, I have read before, but listening to you and how you described it has given me a better understanding of where to start, at the very least, you know, where to begin. It's like anything else, I think it's just something I've got to keep on practicing.
Yeah.
And also it's very important. Try and incorporate this when I'm just doing my regular everyday thing.
Yes.
Particularly concentration. Yeah, I'll give you an example real quick. I went to work this morning and my work has a scale. So I took my wallet out because that'll looked at me like if I had a chance. So I step on the scale, okay, I walk away, I get the wallet in my pocket. 10-15 minutes later, I go, where's my wallet? I went running home. I was in church that morning. I ran back to the church to see if it was in the church.
Yeah.
I mean, just by not concentrating and not being aware of what I was doing, it didn't dawn on me until about a half hour later and a whole lot of panicking that my wallet was fine sitting in the office where I work. That's not good. But I can think of other examples of not concentrating and not being aware and staying in the moment. And, you know, what happened to me this morning was kind of a, you know, it was enlightening to say, wow, I can just forget something that quick. And then go into a panic over something that if I was calm and if I was paying attention, probably would never have happened.
Yeah, but what a great example of your own contribution to dukkha, to suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And it was your reaction in that. When it was, and it's an understandable reaction. I may have reacted the same way. You lose your wallet, you tend to panic.
Yeah.
But that it's in that reaction that you're actually developing mindlessness. And it's because of your reaction, but you also saw that you can be in control of that. It's important to say that if tomorrow the same thing happens, if you really want to develop the Dhamma, you won't judge yourself harshly for that. And it sounds like you're not. You're just accepting this as what's occurring.
Yeah, but right now I'm kind of finding it just feeling really silly that I actually did that.
Well, even that, it's simply what occurred. Mm-hmm. And ultimately what we gain is the ability to not take anything personally, especially what we're telling ourselves. An important aspect of right speech is not so much what we're saying to other people, but what we're saying to ourselves. And as we deepen concentration, we start to recognize that. And all that we do is let it go. When we recognize less than skillful right speech towards ourselves, or less than skillful speech towards ourselves, we simply recognize it so that we can let it go. We have to bring it into mind. You brought something else up. It takes time to integrate the Eightfold Path.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why we have, I mean, it's the only reason, I guess, that I have classes here, except that I really like to teach, is so that we can do this as a Sangha, as a group, and there's an opportunity on a weekly basis, some people come twice a week, to hear this over and over again in different contexts, and so that we start integrating it. So there's study involved in this. In other words, hopefully you read the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's a meditation practice, but there's also being part of a Sangha and listening to this. Most of the teaching that you'll realize that you've integrated is without doing much effort, but simply exposing yourself to what's here.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to it and doing other things. The more effort you put in, the usually the more effective and quicker you move along. But that being said, Paul, I would be very gentle with yourself. Don't push too hard. The only way you cannot develop awakening is to just stop doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And if you try too hard, you're going to get frustrated.
Yeah.
And I think I said it before. Anything ever comes up, I'm always available to you, email or phone or anything like that. Be gentle with yourself. Short periods of meditation, at least twice a day. And you can certainly meditate more often if you feel like it. But again, when you're first starting out, I wouldn't get into too long of meditation practices until you develop the framework of what's going on. So I'm so glad you both joined tonight.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, that's why we're here. So.
Really good.
And you did reckon, you saw the schedule on the schedule's on the website too, Tuesday night.
Yeah, 7. Tuesday is 7:15 again. And I know since Saturday was 8 in the morning.
8:30.
Okay.
And that's kind of up to you. The Tuesday and the Saturday sanghas are usually a little bit more well attended. Like I said, 12 to 16 folks usually. If you're comfortable on Thursday night, that's fine. But Kevin knows too that there's nothing like being part of that larger sangha too. And they're very warm and welcoming. It's really remarkable what's developed here in Frenchtown. I know that sounds self-aggrandizing, but it's because of who's come here that makes a sangha. It's not me. You might want to be a part of, just pick and choose what you want to do.
I'm looking forward to coming back and doing more. I really enjoy it.
So. Yeah. We enjoy having you, so welcome. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
See you. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Kevin.
I love hearing the main know the basics, but it's the Dhamma. It's what's the most important. And it's great to review it and to hear it and to reconfirm it for myself, you know, to meditate upon it, and to meditate just to breathe.
Yeah.
So, but I don't have anything to add, and thank you for the teaching.
Thank you. But Kevin's been coming for a couple of years now. All right, that's all right.
A year and a half.
Oh,
closer to now.
Wow. But so you were able to see the entire Dhamma in this concise teaching. So
yes.
Because you know you have the foundation of it. And that's really how it works. Once you understand it, any teaching is related to the dependent origination of the Four Noble Truths. So, thank you.
And the teaching, really, it's when John goes over it, it sounds like a lot. Lots of different terminology, lots of numbers, and lots of, you know, eightfold path and four truths, and really it boils down to that, and there's not going to be stuff added.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you got a complete introduction.
Yeah.
There isn't more to it, but there is more there's more to integrate in a way that these other suttas, these other teachings of the Buddha,
mm-hmm.
clarify what we just talked about tonight.
Oh, okay.
And as you deepen your concentration and you become more familiar with it, you'll just see how it fits.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have a lot of aha moments.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly think it'll help you too, Paul.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, I have a good feeling about that.
Yeah, always be gentle with yourself. And tell Lorraine too to be gentle with herself. Diane, good to see you tonight.
Thank you for your continually steadfast way of teaching. The only one of the things I would add, it took a while for me to really catch on to what the Sangha was all about, but one of the things that, and I would sit at home and meditate and think, that was a lousy meditation. I couldn't concentrate on anything. And some days meditation would be absolutely great, and I'd think, I'm almost there. And then the next day it would, you know, fall apart on me again. And it was really nice to have the Sangha be here and hear other people say the same kind of things that they were struggling with as well. And that was encouraging to me, that, and it helped me to be gentle with myself,
mm-hmm.
too. So I'm just very thankful for the teaching.
That's the key, though, huh, Diane? Being gentle with yourself.
I think.
You can't. In anything we do, not just in development. If you're going to develop the Dhamma, you have to let go of judgments of yourself and the Dhamma. But even in life, you know, there's no reason to. It's really our Western culture, which is spread most, unfortunately, around the world, that we think that if we're going to learn something or better ourselves, the first thing is to find out where we're wrong, beat ourselves up for a while, and then somehow we'll get better. And that just doesn't work. That just reinforces wrong views. So begin to depersonalize your views of yourself. Be gentle with yourself, and it's remarkable how quickly you can integrate this and gain some real benefit from it, and stop losing your wallet.
But you know, I was thinking about that wallet thing example. Sometimes I have done something like that,
mm-hmm.
and I kind of learned to think about it as, maybe there was something that if I hadn't gone home, or if I had done something else, something different might have happened that would have hurt me or someone else or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I get so that I even am thankful when I do stuff that seems like far out there. And it also helps me to not beat up on myself. Oh, you stupid idiot, why did you do that kind of thing?
I had that moment. When it finally dawned on me, my wallet's on a shelf inside.
Yeah.
And this is after I went through like a huge panic. Running home by the rain, seeing she saw, running back to church, see if I dropped it under one of the pews. And it was going back to work, trying to figure out how I'm going to regain all the things I just lost. That just had no word. I just remembered where I put it.
But did you feel okay that maybe there was a reason for it all? And that's what I've kind of learned, is when I do something like that, to
mm-hmm.
I don't. One of the things that he talks about is this breath. And when we're breathing, one of the things that he said earlier in the teachings was that when you're in the middle of beating yourself up about something, in discursive thinking and beating up thinking,
mm-hmm.
and you take a breath, it weakens that train of thought,
mm-hmm.
that habitual thinking that you have. So every time you interrupt that with a breath, it loses less strength over your mind, and eventually it will dissipate.
Yeah, you'll find yourself using, in a stressful situation, just reminding yourself to come back to your breath, and it'll immediately begin to bring some calm to you. It's just everything the Buddha taught is taught for a practical reason, to develop a calm and peaceful mind. When he described the quality of mind of an awakened human being, he described that mind as calm, at peace. Isn't that wonderful? And it's really what we're all seeking, except we don't understand how to get it, how to develop it. So it's there for us. Okay, I think I've given out enough information for tonight. Again, always feel free to contact me if you have any questions or concerns. And we always finish our class with something called metta. Metta means goodwill or loving kindness. And that's a very important part of practice. And it's the essence of being gentle with ourselves and with others. And if we really want to be gentle with others, we need to start with ourselves. And this is really what metta is all about. So find your relaxed meditation posture. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And let that mindfulness of your breath unite your mind with your body. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.